selected as providing the strongest grounds for their accusations by Freedom House and other critics from the jingoistic right wing of the political spectrum actually happens to demonstrate the precise opposite of what is alleged. Namely, it provides yet another striking illustration of the subservience of the media to the state propaganda system. The Freedom House study itself provides ample documentation to establish these conclusions and to refute its own specific allegations point by point. Given the major role that this study and the thesis it allegedly established has played in recent ideology, we will give some attention to the chasm that lies between its interpretation and summaries on the one hand and the documentary record that it, in part, presents on the other. The comments and summaries often seriously misrepresent the contents of the documents described or are outright falsifications. The analysis, laced with bitter sarcasm throughout, is thoroughly undermined when compared with the actual documents. When the countless errors and careless and inaccurate comments are corrected, nothing remains of the Freedom House case. The sardonic reference to straw man journalism, CBS exclusives, and the like, referring to alleged misdeeds of the media, is misplaced. Case by case, we find instead Freedom House exclusives. Before proceeding to details, we should take careful note of the background assumptions that guide this inquiry. As we noted, for Braestrup and Freedom House, the allies are the United States, the South Vietnamese client government, and the various South Korean, Thai, Australian, Chinese nationalist, and other forces, largely mercenary, mobilized by the United States. The South Vietnamese include our client government and the armed forces organized, supplied, trained, and directed by the United States, but exclude the indigenous NLF and its supporters, although the U.S. government never had the slightest doubt, and its specialists do not hesitate to concede, that the client regime had little support while its opponents in South Vietnam constituted so powerful a political force that any peaceful settlement was unthinkable. That the United States has a right to conduct military operations in South Vietnam to uproot the NLF and destroy the peasant society in which it was based, that its goals are democracy and self-determination, and that its forces protect and bring security to South Vietnamese peasants are principles taken for granted in the Braestrup Freedom House version, where no patriotic assumption or cliché is ever challenged, or even noticed, so deeply rooted are these doctrines. Correspondingly, the fact that the media coverage surveyed is framed entirely within these patriotic premises passes unnoticed. The Freedom House inquiry cannot perceive fundamental bias favorable to the state because all the premises of state doctrine are taken as given. There is mindlessness here, as Braestrup observes, although it is not quite what he perceives. Rather, we find that Braestrup mindlessly adopts what we referred to in Chapter 3 as a patriotic agenda, even more so than the media he condemns. And as we described in Chapter 1, the function of such flak machines as Freedom House is to ensure that the press stays within the bounds of this patriotic agenda. The Tet Offensive of January 1968 began on January 21st with the siege by North Vietnamese NVA regulars of a U.S. military base at Khe San near the 17th parallel. It was soon apparent that the purpose was to draw U.S. forces away from populated centers, and the siege succeeded in its aim as General Westmoreland rushed combat forces to the northern areas. On January 31st, all major cities and 36 of 44 provincial capitals, along with numerous other towns, came under simultaneous attack by southern NLF resistance forces, Viet Cong, along with some NVA elements. The effects are succinctly summarized by Wallace Thies in his scholarly study of the U.S. strategy of coercing Hanoi. Although U.S. military commanders would later claim that the offensive had been anticipated and that the heavy casualties suffered by the attackers had resulted in a great victory for the Allies, the offensive was in fact a military setback for the American side. To see the threat in the northern provinces and forestall a Dien Bien Phu-type defeat at Khe San, half of all U.S. maneuver battalions in South Vietnam were deployed in I Corps in the north. The rest, along with the bulk of the combat-ready ARVN, GVN, Government of South Vietnam, units, were tied down defending the cities against the possibility of a second wave of attacks. As a result, the countryside went by default to the NLF, the pacification program was left in shambles, and whatever losses the DRVVC, North Vietnamese Viet Cong, forces did suffer in the initial assaults were largely offset by the unimpeded recruiting that they conducted in the rural areas in the weeks that followed. International Voluntary Services, IVS, which had a close familiarity with the situation in rural areas, withdrew most of its field workers in early 1968 because of security conditions. A volunteer reported in February, "The number of locations at which we can safely place a volunteer have significantly decreased in recent months." Another added that, "We all knew that security in the countryside was getting worse and worse." Contrary to the optimistic evaluations of the U.S. High Command and Washington, which were relayed with little skepticism by the media in the pre-Tet period, a South Vietnamese senator estimated that after Tet, the government controlled only one-third of the country, the remaining two-thirds being in the hands of the NLF, an estimate consistent with U.S. intelligence reports. The Tet Offensive left Washington in a state of troubled confusion and uncertainty. Undersecretary of the Air Force Townsend Hoops observed, and performed the curious service of fully revealing the doubters and dissenters to each other in a lightning flash within the Pentagon. While General Westmoreland persisted with the optimistic assessments that had been undermined by the dramatic demonstration that the NLF remained firmly rooted in the South despite the devastating American attack on the rural society, the reaction in official Washington circles was quite different. Summarizing the impact in Washington, George Herring observes that in private, Johnson and his advisors were shocked by the suddenness and magnitude of the offensive, and intelligence estimates were much more pessimistic than Westmoreland. An air of gloom hung over the White House discussions, General Maxwell Taylor later observed, and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Earl Wheeler likened the mood to that following the First Battle of Bull Run. General Wheeler reported that, to a large extent, the VC now control the countryside, the situation being particularly bad in the Mekong Delta, and the Pentagon Systems Analysis Group concluded that our control of the countryside and the defense of the urban areas is now essentially at pre-August 1965 levels, when the U.S. war was being lost, according to General Westmoreland. A U.S. government military historical summary of the offensive in the Mekong Delta, completed in April 1968, concluded that the Tet Offensive in 4th Corps had a devastating effect on the Revolutionary Development Pacification Program. As we shall see, these internal assessments are considerably more pessimistic than those of the media that are denounced for the crime of excessive pessimism by Freedom House standards. We might incidentally note that in 4th Corps, including the Mekong Delta, there were no regular North Vietnam units, according to Defense Secretary McNamara. The Freedom House study states that, in the southernmost delta, it was an Arvin Viet Cong, actually U.S. Viet Cong, guerrilla struggle. And more generally, Hanoi had yet to commit sizable multi-division forces in sustained concerted attacks anywhere in South Vietnam. These assessments are what motivated the mass slaughter campaign carried out in the rural areas of the delta and elsewhere in the post-Tet accelerated pacification campaign discussed earlier. Even before the Tet Offensive, Defense Secretary McNamara had privately concluded that military victory was an unreasonable objective and that the course of the war should be changed. Clark Clifford, who was brought in to replace him after Tet, had long shared such doubts, and they were reinforced by the evidence available to him and by the conclusions of the wise men whom Johnson called in to assess the situation. Dean Acheson, who headed this group of longtime hawks drawn from business and political elites, agreed with Clifford's pessimism and advised Johnson to scale down ground operations, reduce the bombing, and seek every means of terminating hostilities without abandoning South Vietnam. The wise men, after full briefings from diplomatic and military officials, confirmed Acheson's findings. The consensus, as summed up by one of the participants, was that there are no military conclusions in this war, or any military end in the future, so that Johnson should therefore de-escalate the conflict. Notice that at this point some rather serious problems arise concerning the second component of the Freedom House thesis, that the misdeeds of the media caused the public to oppose the war, undermining government resolve and leading to U.S. failure in its, by definition, benevolent aims. To establish the stab-in-the-back component of the Freedom House thesis, it is necessary to show that public opinion was swayed toward opposition to the war by media coverage and that the media and public opinion were a significant factor in the shift of government policy. Neither claim can be sustained. With regard to the course of public opinion, the Freedom House study decisively refutes its own thesis. It includes a chapter on public opinion polls by Burns Roper, which demonstrates, as Braestrup concedes, that there is no available evidence of a direct relationship between the dominant media themes in early 1968 and changes in American mass public opinion vis-a-vis the Vietnam War itself, but rather a continuing slow drift toward the dove side after an initial wave of support for the president and frustration and anger at the foe during the Tet Offensive. A closer examination of their own data undermines the Freedom House thesis even more thoroughly. The early response to the Tet Offensive, during the period when media incompetence and unwarranted pessimism were allegedly at their height, was an increase in the belligerency of the American public. The immediate reaction of the U.S. public was to favor stiffened resistance, that is, U.S. resistance to an attack by South Vietnamese in South Vietnam, and intensified U.S. effort. The major sentiment aroused was, bomb the hell out of them. In late February and March, when the media, in the Freedom House version, were beginning to whisper the true story of American victory, there developed a decided negative reaction to the president's handling of the war and the war itself, and a distinct opposition to more aggressive U.S. military action. In early February 1968, when the impact of the alleged media distortions and pessimism reached its peak, public opinion shifted toward the hawks. Public opinion returned to the pre-Tet figures by late February, when the media were allegedly correcting their earlier errors. By April, after the offensive had ended and the errors had been overcome, albeit in a whisper, there was a sharp shift toward the doves. By April, May, June, measurements had returned to pre-Tet levels. When looked at on this broader timescale, the Tet Offensive appears merely to have caused a minor ripple in a steady changing attitude toward our involvement in the war, a shift toward the position of the doves after an initial shift toward the hawks during the period of media pessimism. Tet was just one more incident that reminded the public that the war was not going well, that the confident predictions out of Washington had to be taken with a grain of salt, and that helped move public opinion in the anti-war direction in which it had been moving for nearly 3 years. Faced with this thorough refutation of one essential component of their thesis, without which the thesis loses all significance even if the residue were tenable, the Freedom House analysts retreat to the position that although the public was unaffected by the perverse behavior of the media, there was an effect on the nation's leadership segment, Burns. A safer claim, since as they concede, no data are available. The director of the Freedom House study, Leonard Sussman, concludes that the Tet Offensive, as portrayed in the media, appeared to have had a far greater effect on political Washington and the administration itself than on the U.S. population's sentiment on the war. The media failures, in short, left the public unaffected or even more supportive of the war while they misled the government, along with presidential advisor Clark Clifford, the wise men from the corporate, political, and military elites, including former top-level military commanders and such media addicts as Dean Acheson, Henry Cabot Lodge, McGeorge Bundy, Douglas Dillon, Robert Murphy, etc. We are asked to believe that their decision to move toward disengagement in a situation that they perceived as one of stalemate was based not on military briefings, intelligence reports, and all the information available at the highest level to official Washington, but on watching the evening news with Walter Cronkite. In short, we can dismiss out of hand the second component of the Freedom House thesis, the component that had dramatic impact and continuing influence within the post-Vietnam right turn among elites, and that has set the agenda for subsequent discussion about the adversarial stance of the media and its grim consequences. We are left with the conclusion that the media were either irrelevant or that they continued to operate within the general confines of the approved ideological system, thus refuting the first component of the thesis as well. All that remains of the Freedom House story is the possibility that the media were incompetent, even malevolent, but ineffectual. Notice that the Freedom House thesis here faces the same logical problem noted earlier with regard to the charges concerning television. If television is as influential as claimed, then the evidence shows that through 1967, it encouraged a decisive majority of viewers to support the war. To evaluate the remaining shreds of the Freedom House thesis, let us continue with the record of the Tet Offensive, now asking whether the media did in fact distort it in their zealous, although utterly ineffectual, efforts to undermine authority. With lavish use of firepower, U.S. forces succeeded in regaining control of the towns and cities. The city of Hue, which had been conquered from its own population by GVN troops with American assistance several months earlier in a desperate U.S. effort to prevent the growth of popular movements calling for democracy and a negotiated political settlement, was 80% destroyed by bombing and shelling, which left 2,000 civilians buried in the smashed ruins, according to U.S. Air Force Undersecretary Townsend Hoops. The Marines listed communist losses at over 5,000, while Hoops states that a sizable part of the communist force of 1,000 men who captured the city escaped, allowing a determination of who constituted the communist losses. U.S. aid in May estimated that some 4,000 civilians were left dead in the ruins of the city, most of them victims of U.S. firepower. In the Mekong Delta, artillery and airstrikes leveled half of My Tho, a city of 80,000, and the provincial capital of Ben Tre, Kien Hoa province, later devastated in the post-Tet terror campaign, with 140,000 inhabitants, was decimated with the justification, as an American colonel put it in one of the most widely quoted statements of the war, "We had to destroy the town to save it." The U.S. command conceded that the enemy were overwhelmingly NLF, not North Vietnamese. Killed and captured outnumbered captured weapons by a factor of 5, an indication of who the enemy really were. Secretary of Defense McNamara estimated NVA forces at 50,000 to 55,000 at the end of 1967, mostly in northern regions, with some 10,000 troops placed in Viet Cong combat units. The total roughly matches third country forces, mostly Korean mercenaries, mobilized by the United States as part of its invasion of South Vietnam, and barely 10% of the U.S. forces of over 500,000 men, even excluding the massive forces engaged in the attack against Vietnam and Laos from the sea and from U.S. sanctuaries from Thailand to the Philippines and Guam, employing means of destruction that dwarfed all else in Indochina. As noted earlier, the Tet Offensive not only reduced Washington to gloomy despair and convinced U.S. elites that there was no realistic hope of a military victory in Vietnam, at a cost acceptable to the United States, but also changed the character of media reporting and commentary, which mirrored the changes in elite opinion. On the ground, American correspondents were able to witness the war at first hand, gaining a view rather different from the sanitized and edited version presented under the control of the American military command. Media commentary at home reflected elite opinion in recognizing that the optimistic forecasts that had been relayed from Washington with little skepticism were inaccurate, and that a long and bitter war lay ahead. But on-the-scene reporting and domestic commentary never veered from the framework of the state propaganda system. In reporting the fighting in Ben Tre and My Tho in the Delta, for example, the press observed that American infantry participated while the towns were blasted by American bombers, helicopter gunships, Navy patrol boats, and artillery to root out the Viet Cong, that is, the South Vietnamese guerrillas who were probably living with the people, according to an American officer quoted by Bernard Weinroth. Nonetheless, the news reports speak of the perceived need to blast the city with jets and helicopter gunships, particularly the poorer and most crowded sections, to save other sections of the city and the lives of thousands of people, Lee Lascaz. People whose lives were threatened not by the southern NLF guerrillas living among them, but by the U.S. forces defending them from the NLF. Because of Tet, Weinrob explains, the protection of Ben Tre was limited, and it was necessary to bring in troops from the U.S. 9th Infantry Division by helicopter and to carry out bombing raids and fire by helicopter gunships and artillery to protect Ben Tre, which has long been a stronghold of the Viet Cong and is sometimes considered a Viet Cong rest and recreation area, while surrounding hamlets thought to be controlled by the Viet Cong have been razed by Allied bombing and artillery attacks and fire from armed helicopters. In Ben Tre itself, The marketplace is rubble, and near the gutted homes, nearby women in shawls sit in the noon heat and mourn with loud groans, while Mead Taw still smells of death, with half the homes destroyed, thanks to the effective protection the population received from their American defenders. Throughout, it is taken for granted that the forces armed, trained, and supplied by the only foreign element in the Delta are the South Vietnamese, not the South Vietnamese guerrillas living among the population in their Viet Cong strongholds, from whom the United States is protecting the population by ferocious bombardment of civilian areas. Recall that we are now evaluating the remaining component of the Freedom House thesis, that the media were suppressing the American victory in their anti-establishment zeal. In fact, they were reporting the story accurately in a narrow sense, but completely within the framework of the government propaganda system, never questioned in a shameful display of media servility. We may imagine what the reaction would be to a comparable performance on the part of the Nazi or Soviet press. Braestrup's final comment that a free society deserves better of its media is accurate enough, although not quite in the sense intended in the Freedom House study. As throughout the war, the standpoint of the media continued to reflect the perceptions and attitudes of the American military. For example, an American official who observed, "What the Viet Cong did was occupy the hamlets we pacified just for the purpose of having the Allies move in and bomb them. By their presence, the hamlets were destroyed." The same New York Times report from Binh Dinh province, the showcase province for pacification, indicates this had been going on unreported well before the Tet Offensive. The enemy moves in December, which several military men called a softening up for the offensive, resulted in a wave of Allied airstrikes on villages. Hundreds of homes were destroyed. The U.S. military resistance, to borrow the Freedom House terminology, took the same form elsewhere. Robert Chaplin reported from the scene that in Saigon, a dozen separate areas comprising perhaps 60 or 70 blocks had been totally burned out. These were almost all residential areas. Most of the damage was the result of rocket attacks by American armed helicopters or other planes, though some of it had been caused by artillery or ground fighting. A modern $10 million textile plant containing 40,000 spindles was entirely destroyed by bombs because it was suspected of being a Viet Cong hideout. Le Monde correspondent Jean-Claude Pomonti observed that in the popular suburbs, the Front, NLF, has proven that the only way to eliminate its control is through systematic destruction. To dislodge it, the Air Force had to level many residential areas. Fleeing the bombardments, tens of thousands of refugees have poured into the center of the city. Charles Moore, whom Freedom House singles out for perhaps the consistently best reporting from Vietnam, reported that in towns such as Hue, Vinh Long, Ben Tre, and My Tho, appalling destruction was wrought when encircled Allied forces took the decision to destroy the attacking Viet Cong forces by destroying the places they had occupied. He quotes an American official in Saigon as stating, "The government won the recent battles, but it is important to consider how they won. At first, the Viet Cong had won and held everything in some towns except the American military compound and a South Vietnamese position." By the government, he means the listener to understand the GVN, who won thanks to U.S. firepower and troops. As in this example, the U.S. government claimed that the Tet Offensive was a military defeat for the communists was widely reported, although the U.S. government officials' perception of an initial Viet Cong victory goes well beyond the typical media accounts of the crime of pessimism. Journalists generally accepted the official claim that Tet was a military defeat for the North Vietnamese and NLF, Daniel Hallin concludes in his review of the press and television. For example, Walter Cronkite, who said at once over CBS on February 14th that, first and simplest, the Viet Cong suffered a military defeat. Clear and forthright. These facts do not comport well with what remains of the Freedom House thesis. The charge that, until late February, the media portrayed the enemy's defeat as a defeat for the Allies in clamorous shouts, only conceding from late February in a whisper that this was not quite accurate, television being the worst offender, with Walter Cronkite the arch criminal. It was this gross incompetence or malevolence that illustrates most dramatically the mindless readiness to believe the worst of the government or of authority in general. In the real world, the facts were quite the opposite, and the last remnants of the Freedom House thesis thus disappear, apart from the charge that the reporting was technically incompetent. Some would contend that the issue of how they won, which concerned the American official cited earlier, is as important as who won in evaluating the significance of the Tet Offensive. This idea never penetrated the minds of Braestrup or his Freedom House associates, however, at the time or in their study. Consider political scientist Milton Sachs, a specialist on Vietnam and a GVN advisor, thanked for providing historical perspective for the Freedom House study. In February 1968, he wrote with no further comment, "In conventional terms, it now seems clear that the communists have suffered a military defeat in their Tet Offensive. They have expended the lives of thousands of their soldiers without securing a single province or district town of significance. U.S. officials, in contrast, were impressed with the fact that the NLF and NVA occupied vast areas previously thought to be controlled, wreaked havoc with the pacification program, and were dislodged only by a further and still more violent U.S. attack on the civil society of South Vietnam. It was feared that it might not be an easy task to convince the populace that the communists were to blame for the slaughter and destruction by U.S. forces. The problem, as reported from Hue by Mark Ribou of Le Monde in April, was that the population appeared to compare Arvin behavior unfavorably with that of the NVA or NLF, while the deepest bitterness and resentment was directed against the Americans, whose blind and systematic bombardment had turned Hue into an assassinated city. This reaction may have also been in part a residue of the deep bitterness and resentment left by the U.S.-backed Arvin conquest of Hue a few months earlier. An IVS worker quoted in Newsweek said, "As difficult as this may be to believe, not a single Vietnamese I have met in Saigon or in the Delta blames the Viet Cong for the events of the past 2 weeks." And in its last issue of the Tet period, Newsweek reported from Hue with the same surprise at this inexplicable reaction, that, curiously, moreover, few of the population point an accusing finger at the North Vietnamese. "When the NVA were here," said one student, "they were polite and well-disciplined, totally different from the government troops, the Americans, or even the Viet Cong. The hope is that the Vietnamese people will blame the communists rather than the Americans for whatever damage is being done," Don Webster reported from Hue on February 12th in the midst of the reconquest of the city by the U.S. Marines. 2 days earlier, John Langle of AP wrote that, "It is still impossible to gauge the breadth of the damage, but few seasoned observers see the devastation of Hue backfiring on the communists. They see as the greatest hope a massive and instant program of restoration underlined by a careful psychological warfare program pinning the blame on the communists." Braestrup places the word devastation in italics as an illustration of the unfairness and anti-American bias of the media. Comment seems superfluous. While the U.S. media rarely strayed from the framework of the state propaganda system, others were unconstrained by these limits. For example, the Le Monde correspondents cited, or British photojournalist Philip Jones Griffiths, who concluded from his observations on the scene that the thousands of civilian victims of the reconquest of Hue were killed by the most hysterical use of American firepower ever seen, and then designated as the victims of a communist massacre. To comprehend fully the nature of the Freedom House charges, we may imagine how the inquiry urged by John Rausch might proceed. Who else is implicated in the terrible misdeeds that Freedom House perceives? General Westmoreland and the U.S. command in Saigon must surely be placed on the docket because of their estimates of the early VC successes, along with William Bundy, Assistant Secretary of State for Far Eastern Affairs, given his extreme pessimism. He thought that the Tet Offensive was shattering to the South, especially in the area of pacification, concluding for a time that the South Vietnamese were through. They've had it, where South Vietnamese excludes the South Vietnamese defending their country from a U.S. invasion as usual. These conclusions, which do conform to the Freedom House parody of the media, were based not on the press, but on reports from people in the field out in Vietnam. So presumably they too are implicated. Similarly, Lyndon Johnson was guilty, since he seemed, to some degree, psychologically defeated by the threat to Khe Sanh and the onslaught on the cities of Vietnam. So Braestrup concludes, the same is true of Johnson's civilian advisors, given the air of gloom among them and the Battle of Bull Run mood, and the author of the official U.S. government military historical summary cited earlier, and Dean Acheson and other wise men who urged a shift, of course, because of the same undue pessimism for which the media are condemned by Freedom House. Also, Ambassador Ellsworth Bunker, who reported that the offensive had disrupted the pacification effort for the time being, and the pacification advisor, who reported that in his showcase area, pacification does not exist. Further candidates for investigation appear in the Pentagon Papers, for example, General Wheeler, who summarized the situation in the following terms to the president on February 27th, just as Walter Cronkite was speculating about a stalemate arousing Freedom House ire. The enemy is operating with relative freedom in the countryside, probably recruiting heavily and no doubt infiltrating NVA units and personnel. His recovery is likely to be rapid, his supplies are adequate, and he is trying to maintain the momentum of his winter-spring offensive. Arvin is now in a defensive posture around towns and cities, and there is concern about how well they will bear up under sustained pressure. The initial attack nearly succeeded in a dozen places, and defeat in these places was only averted by the timely reaction of U.S. forces. In short, it was a very near thing. There was no doubt that the RD program, pacification, has suffered a severe setback. To a large extent, the VC now control the countryside. MACV estimates that U.S. forces will be required in a number of places to assist and encourage the Vietnamese army to leave cities and towns and re-enter the country. This is especially true in the Delta. The media reports that Braestrup derides were rarely as pessimistic as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, whose summary of the situation led the president to order the initiation of a complete and searching reassessment of the entire U.S. strategy and commitment in South Vietnam, the Pentagon Papers analyst reports. The CIA must also be investigated for contributing to the decline of free institutions by its pessimism. A CIA paper of March 1st, presumably uninfluenced by Walter Cronkite, expressed grave doubts about the GVN and Arvin, and predicted that they might cease effective functioning in parts of the country so that virtually the entire burden of the war would fall on U.S. forces. Like Cronkite a few days earlier, they expected no better than a standoff in the coming 10 months. Pentagon Systems analysis concluded that the offensive appears to have killed the pacification program once and for all, drawing the conclusion that Braestrup falsely attributes to the media, and estimated that our control of the countryside and the defense of the urban areas is now at pre-August 1965 levels. It was because of this serious situation, not perceived American successes, as Braestrup intimates, that they recommended what was later to be called Vietnamization. The civilian analysts in the Pentagon must be charged not only with undue pessimism, but also with some of the other crimes of the press. For example, they referred to the famous statement that we are destroying South Vietnam in order to save it. Citation of this statement is the target of much Braestrup scorn. We must also include Colonel Herbert Chandler, on whom Braestrup relies for his comment of the Wheeler-Westmoreland request for additional troops. He was, Braestrup says, the anonymous author of the Pentagon Papers section on this material, and here he described as a startlingly accurate account a New York Times article by Neil Sheehan and Hedrick Smith, which, Braestrup claims, was a major example of distorted and incomplete reporting. The authors of the epilogue to the Pentagon Papers must also be included in the indictment, given their pessimistic post-Tet assessment of the price for military victory and the illusory nature of claimed progress. The category of people who were not threatening free institutions by the standards of Freedom House is small indeed, a fact that some may find suggestive. It is significant that the major criticism of the media in the Freedom House study is that they were too pessimistic. Strikingly absent is the obvious standard of comparison. The internal reports from the field and analysis by intelligence and official Washington, which were, if anything, even more pessimistic. The logic of the Freedom House brief against the media is highly revealing. In their view, The media in a free society must not only accept without question the principles of the state doctrinal system, as the media did throughout, a fact that Freedom House never addresses and apparently cannot perceive, but must do so with a degree of enthusiasm and optimism that exceeds that of U.S. intelligence, the military command, Johnson's wise men, and other leading figures in the military, political, and corporate world who draw their information from a full range of government sources. It is an interesting conception of a free society. We might ask how the Freedom House conception of a free press and a free society would be applied by Soviet commissars, let us say, to the case of the mass circulation weekly Ogonyok, which published a series of long articles that presented a bleak picture of the war in Afghanistan, depicting it in stark terms, speaking of poor morale and desertion among Afghan units and tough fighting between elite Soviet troops and Afghan guerrillas, and implying that large areas of Afghanistan are under guerrilla control. The articles also give a broad hint that drug use is common among Russian troops in Afghanistan, and they include extracts from a helicopter pilot's journal describing the sight and smell of colleagues' charred bodies and implying that helicopter losses are high after the receipt of sophisticated Western weaponry by the guerrillas, terrorists who finance themselves by producing drugs for the international market, charges verified by Western observers, incidentally. But it would be inhumane for the USSR simply to withdraw without guarantees for the population, because a Soviet withdrawal would lead to nationwide internecine warfare, as Afghans who are quoted anticipate. The article does not simply mimic standard U.S. media fare, as these excerpts indicate. Thus, it describes an attack on Soviet villages by Afghan guerrillas. One can imagine the U.S. reaction had there been a Viet Cong attack on villages in Texas. But by Freedom House standards, it is plain that the editors merit severe censure for their adversarial stance, pessimism, and volatile styles, always with the dark possibility that, if the managers do not themselves take action, then outsiders in the government will seek to apply remedies of their own. And in fact, in January 1988, General Dmitry T. Yakov, the Soviet defense minister, applied Freedom House and Braestrup principles to the adversarial Soviet press, sharply criticizing articles in Ogonyok and Literaturnaya Gazeta for reporting on the Afghan war in ways that undermined public confidence in the Soviet army and played into the hands of the West. In the light of the evidence presented in the Freedom House study, and of much that is ignored, the following conclusions seem reasonable. During the Tet Offensive and its aftermath, media performance was creditable, sometimes very highly so, in a narrow sense. More broadly, this reporting was highly deceptive in that it was framed within the unchallenged and unrecognized doctrines of the state propaganda system, which impose a severe distortion. Media reports compare favorably in accuracy with those available to official Washington at the highest level from internal sources, although they were regularly less alarmist, perhaps because the media tended to give credence to official statements and were unaware of the internal assessments. The reports from the scene led media commentators to draw approximately the same conclusions as Johnson's high-level advisors. The manner in which the media covered the events had little effect on public opinion, except perhaps to enhance its aggressiveness and, of course, to instill ever more deeply the basic and unexamined tenets of the propaganda system. We have now addressed the argument presented by critics of the media for its alleged adversarial stance on their own chosen grounds, the grounds that they select as the strongest for their case. The propaganda model is once again confirmed, thus meeting the most severe test that can be posed. The model is also vindicated by the manner in which Freedom House fulfills its function as a flak machine, attempting to bully the media into a still more thoroughgoing conformity with the propaganda requirements of state policy by methods that are a travesty of honest journalism, let alone scholarship. All, of course, in the interest of freedom. 5.5.3 The Paris Peace Agreements. The Tet Offensive convinced large sectors of elite opinion that the costs of the U.S. effort were too high. Lyndon Johnson stepped down in what was termed by the government a bombing halt and reported as such. The bombers were shifted from North Vietnamese targets to Laos, where the defenseless rural society of scattered villages in the north was demolished, and later Cambodia, where the same was true on an even more horrendous scale. U.S. forces undertook the violent and destructive post-Tet accelerated pacification campaign in the south, and bombing was intensified to step up refugee programs deliberately aimed at depriving the VC of a recruiting base. In accordance with the advice of pacification director Robert Comer in April 1967, the Phoenix program was established to destroy the infrastructure of the NLF by terror. The burden of ground fighting was shifted to Vietnamese forces supplied and directed by the United States, and U.S. conscripts were withdrawn, a more typical pattern for colonial wars that essentially duplicated the earlier French effort to reconquer Indochina. And the United States finally agreed to pursue the path of a negotiated settlement, although still not relinquishing the aim of preventing the unification of Vietnam and retaining Indochina apart from North Vietnam within the U.S. global system. This was not the maximal goal the United States had pursued. Thus, in the late 1950s, the U.S. government still hoped for unification of Vietnam under anti-communist leadership, and the U.S. client regime always regarded itself as the government of all of Vietnam, GVN equals Government of Vietnam, and so declared in the first and unamendable article of its constitution. But by the late 1960s, if not before, control over all Indochina apart from North Vietnam was regarded as the maximum goal attainable. As we have heard, opportunities for a peaceful diplomatic settlement had long existed, but they had never been pursued because they were regarded as inconsistent with the essential goal, preservation of an independent South Vietnam that would be a U.S. client state. By October 1972, the negotiators in Paris had reached the essential terms of an agreement, the Nine-Point Plan. President Nixon, however, objected to the terms of the agreement, and the Thieu government in Saigon was completely opposed to them. Nixon's hope was to delay further negotiations until after the November presidential elections, when he would have more leverage. The delay would also permit a vast shipment of arms to the GVN, something that would surely be prohibited by the agreements. In an effort to pressure Nixon to sign the agreements, the DRV made the terms public on October 26th in a radio broadcast. In a Washington press conference, Kissinger stated that the Radio Hanoi broadcast gave, on the whole, a very fair account, then offering the following paraphrase: "As was pointed out by Radio Hanoi, the existing authorities with respect to both internal and external politics would remain in office in the South." Thus, Kissinger sought to insinuate that according to the accurate account on Radio Hanoi, the GVN, the existing authorities, would remain in office as the government of the South and would somehow deal with the other party whose status remained mysterious. But what was pointed out by Radio Hanoi, correctly as Kissinger conceded, was something quite different, namely, that the two present administrations in South Vietnam will remain in existence with their respective domestic and external functions, these being the GVN and the PRG, based upon the NLF. Having reached agreement, these two parties were then to move toward reunification, to be carried out step by step through peaceful means with no external, meaning U.S., interference. The differences are crucial. From its earliest days, the war was fought over the question of whether the South Vietnamese people shall decide themselves the political future of South Vietnam, as the October Nine-Point Plan explicitly stipulated must be the case, or whether the United States would enforce the rule of its client regime, the GVN, as the sole legitimate government in the South, in accordance with Kissinger's version of the terms to which he had theoretically agreed, a version that plainly departed radically from the text. Kissinger's announcement that peace is at hand, designed with the upcoming U.S. presidential elections in mind, was also blatant deception. As his distortion of the essential terms of the agreement clearly revealed, the United States was backing away from the settlement and refusing to implement it. Nixon later explained that we had to use Kissinger's press conference to undercut the North Vietnamese propaganda maneuver, namely making public the terms of the agreement, and to make sure that our version of the agreement was the one that had great public impact. This result was substantially achieved, The media characteristically accepted Kissinger's version with no recognition that it was diametrically opposed to the terms of the 9-point plan, though the facts were plain to anyone who troubled to look at the readily available public record. The United States then proceeded with a vast shipment of arms to the GVN while demanding substantial changes in the October agreements. Hanoi, in contrast, publicly insisted that the October agreements be signed. The media adopted the version of events relayed regularly by Kissinger, depicting him as caught between two irrational adversaries, Hanoi and Saigon. The Christmas bombings of Hanoi and Haiphong followed, causing great damage and also the loss of several dozen B-52s. The exact numbers are contested, but the losses clearly shocked the Pentagon, as well as a highly adverse world reaction, although the media continued to relay the Washington interpretation of what had happened. Thus, Stanley Carnow wrote that, evidently, the primary aim of Nixon's bombings of Hanoi was to compel the North Vietnamese to return to negotiations, a curious version of the readily available facts. After the military and political failures of the Christmas bombings, the U.S. government then signed the January peace agreements, which were virtually identical to the terms it had rejected the preceding October, and still more significant, were hardly different in essentials from the NLF proposals of the early 1960s, which caused such dismay in Washington and compelled the U.S. government to escalate the war so as to prevent a political settlement, thus virtually destroying Indochina with millions of casualties and three countries utterly devastated, a fact considered of little moment in the West. The charade that took place in October was reenacted in January. As the agreements were announced on January 24th, the White House made an official statement and Kissinger had a lengthy press conference in which he explained clearly that the United States was planning to reject every essential provision of the accords the administration had been compelled to sign, presenting a version that explicitly violated them at every crucial point. In yet another astonishing demonstration of servility, the media accepted the Kissinger White House version unquestioningly, thus guaranteeing that the Vietnamese enemy would appear to be violating the agreements if it adhered to them. Recall that all of this took place during the period when the media had allegedly reached their peak level of militant opposition to state authority. Let us now briefly inspect this remarkable record. The Paris Agreements committed the United States and all other countries to respect the independence, sovereignty, unity, and territorial integrity of Vietnam as recognized by the 1954 Geneva Agreements on Vietnam. Pending reunification of Vietnam, which is to be carried out step by step through peaceful means and without foreign interference, the military demarcation line at the 17th parallel is to be regarded as only provisional and not a political or territorial boundary. In the South, there are two parallel and equivalent South Vietnamese parties, the GVN and the PRG. This is the central element of the agreements, which proceed to specify in detail the responsibilities and commitments of the two South Vietnamese parties. These are to achieve national reconciliation through peaceful means under conditions of full democratic freedoms, while foreign countries shall not impose any political tendency or personality on the South Vietnamese people, and the United States will not continue its military involvement or intervene in the internal affairs of South Vietnam. The two South Vietnamese parties undertake to respect the ceasefire and maintain peace in South Vietnam, settle all matters of contention through negotiations, and avoid all armed conflict. Furthermore, the two South Vietnamese parties will proceed to achieve national reconciliation and concord, end hatred and enmity, prohibit all acts of reprisal and discrimination against individuals or organizations that have collaborated with one side or the other, and in general, ensure the democratic liberties of the people, which are outlined along with procedures to ensure the reconciliation undertaken by the two South Vietnamese parties. The agreements committed the two South Vietnamese parties not to accept the introduction of troops, military advisors, and military personnel, including technical military personnel, armaments, munitions, and war material into South Vietnam, and called for a total withdrawal of all such personnel within 60 days, while the two South Vietnamese parties will settle the question of Vietnamese armed forces in South Vietnam without foreign interference. In his January 24th press conference, Kissinger made it clear that the United States maintained the right to provide civilian technicians serving in certain of the military branches, and as its forces were withdrawn after the signing of the agreements, the United States proceeded to keep or introduce 7,200 contract civilians to handle maintenance, logistics, and training jobs formerly performed by the U.S. military, many of them retired military men under the supervision of a U.S. Major General. The provisions concerning technical personnel were thus at once nullified, along with the U.S. pledge to refrain from any intervention in the internal affairs of South Vietnam. In a speech of January 23rd, Nixon announced that the GVN would be recognized as the sole legitimate government in South Vietnam, nullifying Articles 9C and 4, as well as the basic principle of the agreements, that the two parallel and equivalent South Vietnamese parties are to proceed toward a settlement with no U.S. interference or effort to impose any political tendency on the people of South Vietnam. In its Summary of Basic Elements of the Vietnam Agreements on January 24th, the White House announced that the government of the Republic of South, in parentheses, Vietnam, continues in existence, recognized by the United States, its constitutional structure and leadership intact and unchanged. The reason for the parentheses being that this constitutional structure identifies the GVN as the government of all Vietnam. This constitutional structure also outlawed the second of the two parallel and equivalent parties, along with pro-communist neutralism and any form of expression aimed at spreading communist policies, slogans, and instructions, and the GVN announced at once that such illegal actions would be suppressed by force, while President Chu stated that this is solely a ceasefire agreement, no more, no less. With these declarations, the United States and its client regime thus nullified the central principle of the Paris Agreements and flatly rejected the provisions for the two South Vietnamese parties to achieve national reconciliation and concord by peaceful means without forceful measures or repression. In short, the United States announced at once, clearly and without equivocation, that it intended to disregard every essential provision of the scrap of paper it was compelled to sign in Paris. Kissinger attempted to obfuscate the matter in his January 24th press conference, reprinted in full in the New York Times. He claimed falsely that we have achieved substantial changes from the October 9-point plan, thus implicitly offering a justification for the Christmas bombings. He stated that what the Civil War has been all about is who is the legitimate ruler of South Vietnam, and is there such a thing as a South Vietnam even temporarily until unification, claiming that the United States had achieved its objectives on these points by virtue of the specific references to the sovereignty of South Vietnam and the right of the South Vietnamese people to self-determination, and declaimed that the United States had also achieved its goal with regard to the status of the demarcation line. All of this was blatant deception. The wording of the agreements reflected the DRV-PRG position in all the respects Kissinger mentioned, while Kissinger's insinuation that the agreements permitted the United States to recognize the GVN as the legitimate ruler of South Vietnam is in explicit contradiction to the agreements he had just signed, as is his attempt to create the impression that the civil war is between North and South Vietnam. The core provision of the Paris Agreements establishes the GVN and the PRG as the two South Vietnamese parties, parallel and equivalent, to move toward unification with the North, abrogating the provisional demarcation line, which has no political status. Kissinger was attempting to confuse sovereignty of South Vietnam with sovereignty within South Vietnam. The latter is what the war was all about from the outset, and the agreements simply reiterated the position of the enemy that this was a matter to be settled by the two South Vietnamese parties without external interference, as in the October 9-point plan. Just as in October, the purpose of this obfuscation was, in Nixon's words, to make sure that our version of the agreement was the one that had great public impact. And again, it succeeded. The media, without exception to our knowledge, accepted the Kissinger White House version as expressing the contents of the agreements, enabling them to interpret the PRG-DRV insistence on the actual terms of the Paris Agreements as an effort to disrupt them. Thus, Joseph Kraft, a liberal dove on these issues, wrote that much of the blame goes to the communists for the subsequent breakdown of the ceasefire because Hanoi has never abandoned the objective of unifying all of Vietnam. That is, Hanoi has never abandoned its objective to living up to the terms of the Geneva Accords of 1954, now explicitly reiterated in the Paris Agreements of January 1973. As a dove, he also added that just as much of the blame goes to President Thieu, but none, of course, can be assigned to Washington. He cites communist military actions in the South and dispatch of equipment as the major reason for the breakdown of the ceasefire, citing no evidence. As we shall see, the facts reveal quite a different reason. At the liberal extreme of U.S. opinion, Tom Wicker wrote that American policy, which never accepted the Geneva Agreement, came to insist instead that South Vietnam was a legally constituted nation being subverted and invaded by another power, and that view is implied even in the documents that finally produced the ceasefire. Wicker adopts Kissinger's version, which is in explicit contradiction to the actual documents. These simply reiterate the long-held position of the NLF and Hanoi with regard to the status of South Vietnam. In the New Republic, Stanley Carnow wrote that the Viet Cong considers the PRG to be a parallel administration, failing to observe that it is not only the Viet Cong, but also the Paris agreements just signed by the United States government that assigned to the PRG a status exactly parallel to that of the GVN. In Newsweek, Stuart Alsop proclaimed that if the marvelously elaborate Nixon-Kissinger settlement survives more or less intact, we will have won the war, which would be true under the Nixon-Kissinger interpretation, although under the evidently irrelevant terms of the Paris agreements, the United States had abandoned its war aims and accepted the basic proposals of the Vietnamese enemy. Newsweek went on to explain in the same issue that Hanoi has now accepted the provision that North and South are divided by a sacrosanct demarcation line, thus tacitly acknowledging the legitimacy of the Saigon regime. Equally vital to the Nixon administration was specific mention of the sovereignty of the Saigon government, and on this point, too, the U.S. had its way. Hanoi finally conceded that, in Kissinger's words, there is an entity called South Vietnam. In one important sense, the dispute over that question was what the war in Vietnam was all about. Again, utterly and transparently false in every respect, as a comparison with the text just quoted immediately demonstrates, although in accord with Kissinger's deceptive version of the agreements, taken as sacrosanct by the loyal media. An honest and independent press would have announced the January agreements with headlines reading, U.S. announces intention to violate the agreements signed in Paris. An informed press would have observed further that the Paris agreements incorporate the principles rejected by the United States at Geneva 20 years earlier, as well as the essential principles of the NLF program of the early 1960s, which were similar to those advocated by Vietnamese quite generally and constituted the crucial fact that impelled the United States to escalate the war so as to block a political settlement among Vietnamese. The actual press simply adopted Washington's version of the agreements, never mentioning that this version contradicted them in every essential respect and thus guaranteed that the war would go on as it did. Once again, the contribution of the media was to help implement further violence and suffering by adopting Washington's version of events. In this case, in the face of the fact that this version was, transparently, in flat contradiction to the documents readily at hand. One would have to search assiduously to discover a more blatant example of media subservience to state power. The aftermath was predictable, predicted in the alternative press, and similar to earlier occasions when the same factors were operative. As after Geneva 1954, the communists, who had won a political victory on paper, attempted to pursue political struggle while the United States and its GVN client at once turned to military force to overturn the terms of the Paris agreements. These facts were reported by the more serious journalists on the scene in Vietnam, notably Daniel Sutherland, who observed from his extensive investigations that the Saigon government has been guilty in by far the greatest number of cases of launching offensive operations into territory held by the other side, assuming that it has the right, despite the ceasefire, to take back territory which it lost in 1972, and giving many examples, as did others. The U.S. government informed Congress cheerily that the GVN has fared well during the post-ceasefire maneuvering, adding 770 hamlets to the list of those over which it has dominant control after the agreements, and in violation of them, a fact that passed without notice. The GVN thus added 1 million people to the area of its control, while expending 16 times as much ammunition as the enemy, and using the newly provided U.S. equipment as intended for massive military operations, including extensive bombardment of PRG areas to prevent refugees from returning to them as provided by the agreements. The media either blamed the communists or sometimes the GVN as well, but not the United States, which had announced at once its intention to disrupt the agreements and now publicly expressed its displeasure in the military actions that successfully achieved this objective. When the North Vietnamese finally responded to U.S. GVN violence, the GVN quickly collapsed, leading to outrage in the U.S. government and media, which still persists, over this dramatic demonstration of communist iniquity, which proves that their intentions all along were to destroy the free and independent government of South Vietnam and to reduce its people to communist tyranny, thus further entrenching the principle that communists cannot be trusted. This useful lesson, firmly established by media complicity in transparent government deceit, has, not surprisingly, been applied in subsequent efforts by the U.S. government to gain its end by violence. One dramatic example was featured in the media in August 1987 when the Central American presidents confounded Washington's strategy by adopting a political settlement that undermined the familiar U.S. reliance on force to compensate for its political weakness. As part of its immediate efforts to sabotage this agreement, the State Department called the Latin American ambassadors to Washington, where they were presented with a copy of the 1973 Paris Peace Agreement that was negotiated to end the U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War, the Wall Street Journal reported, adding that the agreement was subsequently ignored by North Vietnam. The journal explained that this unfortunate Vietnam experience, which proved that agreements with communists are not worth the paper they are printed on, is one factor in administration skepticism about the Central American agreement. Copies of the 1973 Paris agreements were distributed to the envoys as a case study of how an agreement with ambiguous provisions could be exploited and even ignored by a communist government, Neil Lewis reported in the lead story in the New York Times, adding, in violation of the 1973 accord, North Vietnam overran South Vietnam and united the two parts of Vietnam under its banner in 1975. The utility of a carefully crafted historical record, designed by the loyal media to serve the needs of state power, is revealed here with much clarity. Surveying these events, we reach essentially the same conclusions as before, although once again the performance of the media, at the peak period of their alleged independence and adversarial stance, goes well beyond the predictions of the propaganda model, exceeding the expected norm of obedience to the state authorities and reaching the level that one finds in totalitarian states. As before, the servility of the media made a significant contribution to ensuring that the slaughter in Indochina would continue and that the U.S. government would be able to exploit its Vietnam experience as filtered through the media for later exercises in international terrorism. The remarkable performance of the media also laid the basis for the post-war interpretation of what the war was all about and why the United States failed to attain its ends, a matter to which we turn in the next section. 5.6. The Vietnam War in Retrospect. In April 1975, the war came to an end, and the 30-year conflict entered a new phase. Indochina faced the near-insoluble problems of reconstruction in a land that had been reduced to ruin by foreign armies after a century of colonial oppression. In the United States, too, elite groups faced a problem of reconstruction, but of a different kind. The problem in the United States was the reconstruction of ideology, the taming of the domestic population that had lost its faith in the nobility of intent and the inspiring benevolence of the elites who determine U.S. policy. It was necessary to overcome what Norman Podhoretz, echoing Goebbels, calls the sickly inhibitions against the use of military force, the dread Vietnam syndrome, finally cured by the stirring triumph of U.S. arms in Grenada, so Podhoretz hoped. This was part of a larger problem, the crisis of democracy perceived by Western elites as the normally passive general population threatened to participate in the political system, challenging established privilege and power. A further task was to prevent recovery in the societies ravaged by the American assault, so that the partial victory already achieved by their destruction could be sustained. As we have heard, through the mid-60s, the media loyally fulfilled their function of service to state violence, and there was no significant popular opposition to the U.S. attack on Indochina. True, in 1964, the population voted 2-1 in favor of the peace candidate, who was assuring them that we want no wider war, while laying the groundwork for the rapid escalation planned for the post-election period, a noteworthy illustration of the character of electoral politics in a society lacking genuine opposition parties and a critical and independent press. Nevertheless, the enthusiasm of the ideological institutions for the rapid escalation of U.S. efforts to defend South Vietnam from internal aggression helped keep the public in line as the U.S. invading army